Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Neil Stevenson, who reads from and discusses his new book, Anathem, published by William Morrow. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover, and I want to thank you all for coming. And thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. I especially want to thank our customers who do purchase your books here, as that is actually what helps us bring in such amazing authors as we have here tonight. And I know I'm going to introduce someone who needs no introducing to all of you that are sitting here. We are thrilled tonight to have with us Neil Stevenson and his much-awaited new book, An Anthem. Neil Stevenson is the author of the three-volume historical epic, The Baroque Cycle, comprised of Quicksilver, The Confusion, and The System of the World, as well as much other that you're familiar with, best-selling fiction and nonfiction. He also writes for Wired Magazine. So, here from Seattle, Washington, please help me welcome Neil Stevenson.
Thank you. Thanks. 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 My throat is trashed, so we're going to be relying pretty heavily on the PA here. I'll try to stay close to the mic. And Tattered Cover has thoughtfully provided me with cough drops, so I may deploy those as needed. I'm going to read two bits from the book. They're both conversations. They're from early in the book. The first one is literally the first thing in the book, and then I'm going to skip a few pages and read another one. I got to get this set up so the mic isn't blocking my view of the book. Common failure. Failure mode. Do your neighbors burn one another alive? Was how Fra Orlo began his conversation with Artisan Fleck. Embarrassment befell me. Embarrassment is something I can feel in my flesh, like a handful of sun-warmed mud clapped on my head. Do your shamans walk around on stilts? Fra Orlo asked, reading from a leaf that, judging by its brownness, was at least 5 centuries old. Then he looked up and added helpfully, "You might call them pastors or witch doctors." The embarrassment had turned runny. It was horrifying my scalp along a spreading frontier. "When a child gets sick, do you pray? Sacrifice to a painted stick? Or blame it on an old lady?" Now it was sheeting warm down my face, clogging my ears and sanding my eyes. I could barely hear Fra Orlo's questions. "Do you fancy you will see your dead dogs and cats in some sort of afterlife?" Orlo had asked me along to serve as amanuensis. It was an impressive word, so I had said yes. He had heard that an artisan from Extramuros had been allowed into the new library to fix a rotted rafter that we could not reach with our ladders. It had only just been noticed, and we didn't have time to erect proper scaffolding before Appert. Orlo meant to interview that artisan, and he wanted me to write down what happened. Through drizzly eyes, I looked at the leaf in front of me. It was as blank as my brain. I was failing. But it was more important to take notes of what the artisan said. So far, nothing. When the interview had begun, he had been dragging an insufficiently sharp thing over a flat rock. Now he was just staring at Orlo. "Has anyone you know ever been ritually mutilated because they were seen reading a book?" Artisan Fleck closed his mouth for the first time in quite a while. I could tell that the next time he opened it, he'd have something to say. I scratched at the edge of the leaf just to prove that my quill had not dried up. Fra Orlo had gone quiet and was looking at the artisan as if he were a new-found nebula in the eyepiece of a telescope. Artisan Fleck asked, "Why don't you just spiel in?" "Spiel in," Fra Orlo repeated to me a few times as I was writing it down. I spoke in bursts because I was trying to write and talk at the same time. When I came, that is, before I was collected, they had a thing called a spiele. We didn't say spiel in, we said cruise the spiele. Out of consideration for the artisan, I chose to speak in Fleckish, and so this staggering drunk of a sentence only sounded half as bad as if I'd said it in Orth. "It was a sort of moving picture," Orlo guessed. He looked to the artisan and switched to Fleckish. "We have guessed that to spiel in means to partake of some moving picture praxis, what you would call technology, that prevails out there." "Moving picture, that's a funny way to say it," said the artisan. He stared out a window as if it were a spiele showing a historical documentary. He quivered with a silent laugh. "It is praxic Orth, and so it sounds quaint to your ears," Fra Orlo admitted. "Why don't you just call it by its real name?"
"Spieling in?"
"Yeah. Because when Fra Erasmus here came into the math 10 years ago, it was called cruising the spiele, and when I came in almost 30 years ago, we called it Farspark. The avowed who live on the other side of yonder wall, who celebrate Apert only once every 100 years, would know it by some other name. I would not be able to talk to them." Artisan Fleck had not taken in a word after Farspark. "Farspark is completely different," he said. "You can't watch Farspark content on a spiele. You have to upconvert it and reparse the format." Orlo was as bored by that as the artisan was by talk of the hundreders, and so conversation thudded to a stop long enough for me to scratch it down. My embarrassment had gone away without my noticing it, as with hiccups. Artisan Fleck, believing that the conversation was finally over, turned to look at the scaffolding that his man had erected beneath the bad rafter. "To answer your question," Fra Orlo began.
"What question?"
"The one you posed just a minute ago. If I want to know what things are like extramuros, why don't I just spiel in?"
"Oh," said the artisan, a little confounded by the length of Fra Orlo's attention span.
"I suffer from attention surplus disorder," Fra Orlo liked to say.
"First of all," Fra Orlo said, "we don't have a spiele device."
"Spiele device?"
Waving his hand as if this would dispel clouds of linguistic confusion, Orlo said, "Whatever artifact you use to spiel in."
"If you have an old Farspark resonator, I could bring you a down converter that's been sitting in my junk pile."
"We don't have a Farspark resonator either," said Fra Orlo.
"Why don't you just buy one?"
This gave Orlo pause. I could sense a new set of embarrassing questions stacking up in his mind. "Do you believe that we have money? That the reason we are protected by the secular power is because we are sitting on a treasure hoard? That our millenarians know how to convert base metals to gold?" But Fra Orlo mastered the urge.
"Living as we do under the Cartesian discipline, our only media are chalk, ink, and stone," he said. "But there is another reason, too."
"Yeah, what is it?" demanded Artisan Fleck, very provoked by Fra Orlo's freakish habit of announcing what he was about to say instead of just coming out and saying it.
"It's hard to explain, but for me, just aiming a spiele input device, or a Farspark chamber, or whatever you call it, a spiele captor, at something doesn't collect what is meaningful to me. I need someone to gather it in with all their senses, mix it round in their head, and make it over into words."
"Words," the artisan echoed, and then aimed sharp looks all round the library.
"Tomorrow Quinn's coming instead of me," he announced, then added a little bit defensively, "I have to counter-strafe the new Clanex recompensators. The fan-out tree's starting to look a bit clumpy, if you ask me."
"I have no idea what that means," Orlo marveled.
"Never mind. You ask him all your questions. He's got the gift of gab." And for the third time in as many minutes, the artisan looked at the screen of his G-jaw. We'd insisted he shut down all of its communications functions, but it still served as a pocket watch. He didn't seem to realize that in plain sight out the window was a clock 500 feet high. I put a full stop at the end of the sentence and aimed my face at a bookshelf because I was afraid that I might look amused. There was something in the way he'd said, Quinn's coming instead of me that made it seem he just decided it on the spot. Fra Orlo had probably caught it, too. If I made the mistake of looking at him, I would laugh, and he wouldn't. The clock began chiming provener. "That's me," I said. Then I added, for the benefit of the artisan, "Apologies, I must go wind the clock." "I was wondering," he said. He reached into his toolbox and took out a poly bag, blew off sawdust, undid its seal, which was of a type I had never seen before, and withdrew a silver tube the size of his finger. Then he looked at Fra Orlo hopefully. "I don't know what that is, and I don't understand what you want," said Fra Orlo. "A spelecaptor." "Ah, you have heard about Provener, and as long as you're here, you'd like to view it and make a moving picture?" The artisan nodded. "That will be acceptable, provided you stand where you are told. Don't turn it on." Fra Orlo raised his hands and got ready to avert his gaze. "The warden regulant will hear of it. She'll make me do penance. I'll send you to the Eta. They'll show you where to go." And more in this vein, for the discipline was made up of many rules, and we had already made a muddle of them in Artisan Fleck's mind by allowing him to venture into the decenarian math. So the next conversation takes place on the following day. "Are people starving to death, or are they sick because they are too fat?" Artisan Quinn scratched his beard and thought about that one. "You're talking of slines, I assume." Fra Orlo shrugged. Quinn thought that was funny. Unlike Artisan Fleck, he was not afraid to laugh out loud. "Sort of both at the same time," he finally admitted. "Very good," said Fra Orlo in a now-we're-getting-somewhere tone and glanced at me to make sure I was getting it down. After the Fleck interview, I had had words with Fra Orlo. "Pa, what are you doing with that 500-year-old questionnaire? It's crazy." "It is an 800-year-old copy of an 1100-year-old questionnaire," he had corrected me. "It'd be one thing if you were a hundreder, but how could things have changed that much in only 10 years? Fra Orlo had told me that since the Reconstitution there had been 48 instances in which radical change had occurred in a decade, and that two of these had culminated in sacks. So perhaps the sudden ones were the most important. And yet, 10 years was a long enough span of time that people who lived extramuros, immersed in day-to-day goings-on, might be oblivious to change. So a tenor, reading an 1100-year-old questionnaire to an artisan, could perform a service to the society extramuros, assuming anyone out there was paying attention, which might help to explain why we were not only tolerated but protected, except when we weren't, by the secular power. The man who looks at a mole on his brow every day when he shaves may not see that it is changing. The physician who sees it once a year may easily recognize it as cancer. "Do you have in your wigwams or tents or skyscrapers or wherever you live?" "Trailers without wheels, mostly," said Artisan Quinn. "Very well. In those, is it common to have things that can think but that are not human?" "We did for a while, but they all stopped working and we threw them away." "Can you read? And by that I don't just mean interpreting logotype." "No one uses that anymore," said Quinn. "You're talking about the symbols on your underwear that tell you not to use bleach, that sort of thing." "We don't have underwear or bleach, just the bolt, the cord, and the sphere," said Fra Orlo, patting the length of cloth thrown over his head, the rope knotted around his waist, and the sphere under his bottom. This was a weak joke at our expense to set Quinn at ease. Quinn stood up and tossed his long body in a way that made his jacket fly off. He was not a thick-built man, but he had muscles from working. He whirled the jacket round to his front and used his thumbs to thrust out a sheaf of tags sewn into the back of the collar. I could see the logo of a company which I recognized from 10 years ago, though they had made it simpler. Below it was a grid of tiny pictures that moved. Kinograms. They obsoleted logotype. I felt old. A new feeling for me. Orlo had been curious until he'd seen the kinograms. Now he looked disappointed. "Oh," he said in a mild and polite tone of voice, "you are talking bullshite." I got embarrassed. Quinn was amazed. Then his face turned red. It looked as if he were talking himself into being angry. "Fra Orlo didn't say what you think," I told Quinn and tried to punctuate it with a chuckle, which came out as a gasp. "It's an ancient Orth word." It sounded a lot like, I know, but Frau Orlo has forgotten all about the word you are thinking of. It's not what he meant. What did he mean then? Frau Orlo was fascinated that Quinn and I were talking about him as if he weren't there. He means that there's no real distinction between kinograms and logotype. But there is, Quinn said. They're incompatible. His face wasn't red anymore. He drew breath and thought about it for a minute. Finally, he shrugged. But I see what you mean. We could have gone on using logotype. Why do you suppose it became obsolete then? Asked Orlo. So that the people who brought us kinograms could gain market share? Orlo frowned and considered this phrase. That sounds like bullshite, too. So that they could make money. Very well. And how did those people achieve that goal? By making it harder and harder to use logotype and easier to use kinograms. How annoying. Why did the people not rise up in rebellion? Over time, we were led to believe that kinograms really were better. So I guess you're right. It really is bull. But he stopped in mid-word. You can say it. It's not a bad word. Well, I won't say it because it feels wrong to say it here in this place. As you wish, Artisan Quinn. Where were we? Quinn asked, then answered his own question. You were asking me if I could read not these, but the frozen letters used to write Orth. He nodded at my leaf, which was growing dark with just that sort of script. Yes. I could if I had to, because my parents made me learn, but I don't because I never have to, said Quinn. My son, now he's a different story. His father made him learn? Fra Orlo put in. Quinn smiled. Yes. He reads books? All the time. His age? Obviously, this was not on the questionnaire. 11, and he hasn't been burned at the stake yet. Quinn said that in a very serious way. I wondered if Frau Orlo understood that Quinn was making a joke, taking a dig at him. Orlo made no sign. You have criminals? Of course. But the mere fact that Quinn responded in this way caused Orlo to jump to a new leaf of the questionnaire. How do you know? What? You say, of course there are criminals, but if you look at a particular person, how do you know whether or not he is a criminal? Are criminals branded, tattooed, locked up? Who decides who is and isn't a criminal? Does a woman with shaved eyebrows say, you are a criminal, and ring a silver bell? Or is it rather a man in a wig who strikes a block of wood with a hammer? Do you thrust the accused through a donut-shaped magnet? Or use a forked stick that twitches when it is brought near evil? Does an emperor hand down the decision from his throne written in vermilion ink and sealed with black wax? Or is it rather that the accused must walk barefoot across a griddle? Perhaps there is ubiquitous moving picture praxis, what you'd call spiele captors, that know all, but their secrets may only be unlocked by a court of eunuchs, each of whom has memorized part of a long number. Or perhaps a mob shows up and throws rocks at the suspect until he's dead. I can't take you seriously, Quinn said. You've only been in the consent, what, 30 years? Fra Orlo sighed and looked at me. 29 years, 11 months, 3 weeks, 6 days. And it's plain to see that you're boning up for Appert, but you can't really think that things have changed so much. Another look in my direction. Artisan Quinn, said Fra Orlo, after a pause to make his words hit harder, this is anno 3689 of the Reconstitution. That's what my calendar says, too, Quinn affirmed. 3690 is tomorrow. Not only the Unarian math, but we Decenarians as well will celebrate Appert. According to the ancient rules, our gates will open. For 10 days we shall be free to go out, and visitors such as you shall be welcome to come in. Now, 10 years hence, the centenarian gate will open for the first and probably the last time in my life. When it closes, which side of that gate will you be on? Quinn asked. I got embarrassed again because I'd never dare ask such a question, but I was secretly delighted that Quinn had asked it for me. If I am found worthy, I should very much like to be on the inside of it, said Fra Orlo, and then glanced at me with an amused look as if he'd guessed my thoughts. The point is that in 9 or so years I can expect to be summoned to the upper labyrinth, which separates my math from that of the centenarians. There I shall find my way to a grate in a dark room, and on the other side of that grate shall be one of those hundreders, unless they have all died, vanished, or turned into something else, who shall ask me questions that shall seem just as queer to me as mine do to you. For they must make preparations for their appert just as we do for ours. In their books they have records of every judicial practice that they and others in other consents have heard of in the last 3,700 odd years. The list that I rattled off to you a minute ago is but a single paragraph from a book as thick as my arm. So even if you find it to be a ridiculous exercise, I should be most grateful if you'd simply describe to me how you choose your criminals. Will my answer be entered in that book? If it is a new answer, yes. Well, we still have magistrate doctors who roam about at the new moon in sealed purple boxes. Yes, those I remember. But they weren't coming around as often as we needed them. The powers that be weren't doing a good job of protecting them, and some got rolled down hills. Then the powers that be put up more spielecaptors. Fra Orlo jumped to a new leaf. Who has access to those? We don't know. Orlo began moving to yet another new leaf, but before he found it, Quinn continued, But if someone commits a bad enough crime, the powers that be clamp a thing on their spine that makes them sort of crippled for a while. Later it falls off, and then they're normal again. Does it hurt? No. A new page. When you see someone wearing one of those devices, can you tell what crime they committed? Yes, it says right on it, in kinograms. Theft? Assault? Extortion? Sure. Sedition? Quinn waited a long time before saying, I've never seen that. Heresy? Well, that would probably be handled by the Warden of Heaven. Fra Orlo threw his hands up so high that his bolt fell away from his head and even bared one of his armpits. Then he brought them down again, the better to clamp them over his face. It was a sarcastic gesture that he liked to make in a chalk hall when a fid was being impossibly blockheaded. Quinn clearly took its meaning and became embarrassed. He shifted back in his chair and pointed his chin at the ceiling, then lowered it again and looked at the window he was supposed to be mending. But there was something in Fra Orlo's huge gesture that was funny and gave Quinn the feeling that it was okay. All right, Quinn finally said. I never thought of it like this, but now that you mention it, we have three systems. The chaps in the purple boxes, the spine clamps, and this new thing that neither I nor Fra Erasmus has ever heard of called the Warden of Heaven, said Fra Orlo, and began pushing through many leaves of his questionnaire, digging deep. Something had occurred to Artisan Quinn. I never mentioned them because I thought you'd know all about them. Because, Fra Orlo said, finding the page he'd been looking for and scanning it, they claimed that they came from the consent, bringing the enlightenment of the Mathic world to a worthy few. Yeah, didn't they? No, they didn't. Seeing just how taken aback Quinn was, Orlo continued, This sort of thing happens every few hundred years. Some charlatan will appear and make a claim on secular power based on an association with the Mathic world, which happens to be fraudulent. I knew the answer to the following question before I blurted it out. Does Artisan Fleck, is he a follower, a disciple of the Warden of Heaven? Quinn and Orlo both looked at me, agog for different reasons. Yes, Quinn said. He listens to their casts while he works. That's why he made a spiele of Provener, I said, because this Warden of Heaven claims to be part of us. If there's anything mysterious or, well, magnificent about this place, why, that just makes the Warden of Heaven seem that much bigger and more powerful. And to the extent that Artisan Fleck is a disciple of the Warden of Heaven, he feels some of that belongs to him. Orlo said nothing, which made me embarrassed at the time. When I thought about it later, though, I understood that he didn't need to say anything, because what I'd said was obviously true. Quinn was looking a little confused. Fleck didn't make a spiele. I beg your pardon? I said. Fra Orlo was still distracted, thinking about the Warden of Heaven. They wouldn't allow it. His spiele captor was too good, Quinn explained. Being old and wise, Fra Orlo went rigid, pursed his lips, and looked uneasy. Being neither, I said, What on earth does that mean? Fra Orlo's hand came down on my wrist and prevented me from writing any more, and I suspect that his other hand wanted to clamp down on Quinn's mouth. Quinn went on, The Eagle Res, the Steady Hand, the Dynazoom, put those all together and it could have seen straight across into the other parts of your minster, even through the screens. Or at least that's what he was told by the Artisan Quinn, Fra Orlo trumpeted, loud enough to draw looks from everyone else in the library. Then he made his voice quite low. I am afraid you are about to tell us something that your friend Fleck learned from talking to the Ita, and I must remind you that such a thing is not allowed under our discipline."
"Sorry," Quinn said. "It's confusing."
"I know it is."
"All right, forget about the Spiele captor. I'm sorry. Where were we?"
"We were talking about the Warden of Heaven," Fra Orlo said, relaxing a little and finally letting go my wrist. "And as far as I'm concerned, the only thing we need to establish is whether he is a throwback-turned-mystagogue or a bottle-shaker, as the former can be quite dangerous."
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 30th, 2008.